Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Official Kyiv and its media trolls have made much of the recent counteroffensive. However, their gleeful backing of Ukraine has demonstrated beyond a doubt this is a NATO war on Russia. The stakes could not be higher. One side will lose, and badly. Crosstalking NATO's war on Russia, I'm joined by my guest, Garland Nixon, in Washington. He's a political analyst. In Tampa, we have Larry Johnson. He is managing partner for Berg Associates and a former CIA analyst and U.S. Department of State counterterrorism official. And here in Moscow, we have Maxim Suchkov. He is the director of the Institute of International Studies at Moscow State Institute of International Relations. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let's go to Larry first in Tampa. Much has been made about this counteroffensive around Kharkov. Not much was gained, not much was lost at the end of the day, but it's good media fodder, good for the propaganda narrative. What is not mentioned in the narrative is that during the summer, the Ukrainian army was destroyed. Now we have a NATO army with Ukrainian foot soldiers and mercenaries, but this is NATO's war against Russia. Agree or disagree with that? Go ahead, Larry.
Well, it's certainly moving in that direction. There were still Ukrainians leading, quote, leading the fight on this, but when you looked at the quality of the troops, they were untrained, they had little experience, and they did not know how to properly use the weapons. It was shocking, an article in the Washington Post earlier this week with interviewed individuals in the hospital, wounded right. Ukrainian soldiers. And when they go through that, these guys are saying, look, we're getting outgunned. We're losing five of us to every one Russian that's dying, or one Ukrainian from the Donbass. And we send out five shells and we're getting hit with 100. So that is enabled by NATO. NATO is making that happen. And I think it's becoming a very dangerous situation, because I think I just saw a comment or a message from Russia to NATO that, you know, if you put in long-range weapons, you have crossed a red line, and the Russians don't make idle threats.
Well, Maxim, this basically the same question to you, because the way it's framed, this is Russia and Ukraine. But it seems, I mean, and Zelensky said already in the last few days on CNN that without American support, he can't continue his effort here. And then you have Western media sources gleefully saying, yeah, well, the Americans and NATO, they were all behind the great offensive in Kharkov. I mean, it's not internationalized, it's NATO-ized, and it's pitting Russia against NATO. And in a conflict like this, there's no win-win, as they like to say. One's going to lose here. This is what I agree with Larry. This is getting very scary. Go ahead, Maxim.
Well, the thing here is that it not just demands a kind of a certain reconfiguration of military efforts on the Russian side, which I think will happen in the short term. It also means that if NATO is throwing all its force and weight behind Ukraine, and it's clearly the potentials of NATO and Russia are asymmetric. And you know, in this kind of conventional warfare, Russia is likely to lose, which is not accepted by Moscow. That demands really reconfiguring the approach to the warfare and trying to advance to other domains, including non-military domains. We've seen Russia have used these tools as well, but it also demands on the part of Russia to inflict more pain on NATO countries, including on their, public support for support for Ukraine, and also their, economic standing and military standing. So it indeed gets us in a more dangerous spiral of confrontation, where we're not climbing the escalation, but jumping the escalation ladder. And there's still some of the lethal military tools that Russia has at its disposal, which it hasn't used so far. So there's still a lot of potential for the escalation, but it only will worsen things for everyone.
Well, Garland, let me go to you in Washington here. We did immediately after the so-called counteroffensive, we saw that the electricity grid in much of Ukraine went down. That was no accident, obviously, here. And it's a reminder to everyone, kind of an echo at what Maxime said, is that there's a rush. The Russia has a lot of tools in its toolbox still. It has weapon systems that it has not used. There's been no strategic bombing. There's been no major attack on command and control centers. That's still all out there, and it's all very possible. And I expect it. Garland.
Yes, and there's a hand that Russia doesn't even have to play, and that's, you know, General Winter is about to come riding in on his snowy white steed into Europe. I think there's a lot of talk about should Russia escalate. I think there is a certain level of desperation within NATO and within the EU countries, because they know within the next couple months this thing's going to fall apart for them.
Yep.
I don't think personally Russia has to. Yeah, I would add soldiers simply because some of the areas they lost simply was because they didn't have enough personnel on the ground to hold those places, and they had to retreat. And of course, the other side argued that it was, you know, some kind of a massive defeat. But in reality, if they kind of hold tight and make a few minor adjustments within the next few months, the EU countries are going to be in deep and serious trouble. So I don't think Russia has to make as big a moves as a lot of people. I think they've got, you know, a lot of things on their times on their side, as the Rolling Stone said.
Okay, well, I'm going to use another phrase here. Let me go back to Larry here. We heard it a lot in Afghanistan. You've got the clocks, but we've got the time. So in this case, who's got the clocks and who's got the time? Larry.
Russia has both.
I asked Scott Ritter the same exact question on this program, and he gave me the same exact answer. My goodness, go right ahead, Larry.
Well, we didn't coordinate on that, but NATO does not have the troops to put into, let's just say that they wanted to and back up the Ukrainian army and flow in. They don't have it. What we've seen in this latest offensive by the Ukrainians is they don't have the ability to carry out an attack in depth. What that means is they're not only hitting the troops that are in front of them, but they would be attacking Russian airfields, Russian artillery emplacements. They would be disrupting supply centers in the rear. Then they would carry that out with fixed-wing aircraft, rotary-wing aircraft, missiles. They don't have that. And so they're really fighting with not enough weaponry, not enough armament, and NATO doesn't have the capacity to provide that. At the same time, Europe is literally into an economic tailspin, Germany in particular. And so the economic elements of this, as Garland correctly noted, General Winter is coming. And then so this is going to further limit what the West can do. And yet they're becoming more desperate. The euphoria over this inconsequential retaking of Kharkov, because it was a tactical withdrawal by the Russians. They were not being chased down the street with a bunch of angry Ukrainian soldiers. They withdrew. The Ukrainians come in. They're out in the open, much easier to kill.
Maxime, going back to who's got the time and who's got the clocks here, I mean, at some point, I would imagine, I mean, you know, it's so propagandized, the narrative, let's kind of unpack it here. I mean, NATO countries are supplying arms to kill Russians, okay? So why is Russia still exporting energy to Europe?
Well, I guess this is a question that a lot of people here in Russia are asking, and in this sense, you know, it should be understood in the West, which perhaps it is in some circles, but it isn't in others, that there is a lot of pressure on Putin to take more draconian measures, because you have this image of Putin being the worst guy on the planet. But if you look at it from the perspective from inside Russia, he's been relatively mild in his actions, and a lot of people in a lot of circles are putting pressure on the Kremlin to act in a more decisive way. And you know, you asked about the energy supplies. Some are calling for a deliberate destruction of bridges and lines of supply of NATO weaponry to Ukraine, which has, you know, happened just occasionally, but probably not enough for you know, because these armaments are emboldening and enabling Ukrainian offensives and so-called counteroffensives. So I think the warnings, and this is usually the kind of the protocol for the Russian diplomacy, there's a tons of warning coming up front. And if they're not listened to, then, you know, certain actions follow. The thing here, I believe, is that the Russian warnings were not taken seriously in November, in December last year, in January last year. And then we ended up with the type of mess we're dealing with today. And again, we see some publications and mainstream U.S. media that say, well, Russia is bluffing. They're not going to do anything. And you know, some circles are putting more pressure on Western capitals, including on the Biden administration, to supply more lethal weapons and to be, you know, more open about their, you know, support for Ukraine. That would have consequences. As you accurately noted, Peter, in your introductory remarks, this is the fight that no party can afford to lose. There can be no win-win. And, you know, if we are to talk, you know, about the end game here, that's obviously there is some incentives for to be able to find some political settlements. But the way the West is approaching this conflict is that they can win this war of attrition with Russia.
Maxime, I mean, but, you know, I'm sorry, and I'm agreeing with you here, but, you know, we had the entire Minsk 1 and 2, and we have the same interlocutors. They did nothing then. They were not good faith actors. Why should Russia interact with them on a political level now?
Well, obviously, I don't disagree with you on this one. This was perhaps a way to suggest that the policymakers in Washington should look into the approach where they can believe that by over-financing Ukraine, over-military supply in Ukraine, they can get an upper hand here. And, you know, not encourage any thinking in terms of political settlements here, you know, talking about the red lines and demands and things like this. There is absolutely, in my view, no appetite for political settlement here.
All right. On that point no appetite for political settlement. Gentlemen, we're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on NATO's war on Russia. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. To remind you, we're discussing NATO's war on Russia. Okay, let's go back to Garland in D.C. I want to continue the discussion that I was having with Maxime. Garland, I mean, it was already mentioned here in December, the Russians sent out two notes, ultimatums, whatever you want to call them, to NATO and to the United States. They were turned down. They were not taken seriously about the prospects of a military technical reaction to for Russia to ensure its security. That was ignored. Then we had February 24th. Then we had the Istanbul process, where the Zelensky regime appeared to be on the brink of making some kind of compromise to wind the war down. We know now that Boris Johnson and others blew it off, said, no, we're going to we won't. If you make a peace, we're not going to be backing you. We won't have your back. OK. All right. I mean, and we can go, you know, back 8 years if you want, all the way from the coup. So I don't see any kind of settlement here. There's, you know, Joseph Borrell, which is a buffoon, the chief diplomat for Europe. He said it'll be settled on the battlefield. Well, that's one thing I agree with him on. Go ahead, Garland.
I don't necessarily agree with him on that. And as far as any type of diplomatic settlement, as we say here in the black community in America, there's a saying that goes like this: when somebody shows you who they are, believe them.
Yeah.
So the reality is they've got to understand that the actual plan for the U.S. empire is not to get any kind of a settlement. It's to destroy Russia, to tear Russia to pieces, and to steal the resources. You cannot bargain with someone who plans to swap. A sheep can't bargain with a wolf. They plan to swallow you whole. So, but the issue, I think, is not the battlefield. Right now, the weakness of NATO, the weakness of EU is political and economic. So if Russia's right now, their strength is to say, well, you've got people in the streets everywhere, they're not happy. You've you just had a economic turn of events in Italy, I mean, political, in Sweden. So realistically, the right now, one of the things that I think that's happening with the U.S.'s empire large coalition. You notice I don't say NATO because NATO is nothing but an umbrella organization for the U.S. to control Europe's foreign policy. But right now, their concern is that things are falling apart and that their coalition is going to fall apart with the anger of EU citizens. So, I a lot of people think it's the battlefield. I don't think that's where this thing's decided. I think when the people of Europe start tearing Europe literally brick by brick to pieces, either there will be new leadership in Europe or there won't be much of Europe left. Cold, hungry, angry people are not rational, and they can be very violent.
Well, Larry, I tend to agree with Garland, but the Americans will turn to the Europeans and say, well, you have to suffer, okay? I mean, you know, that's one of the great mysteries for me. You know, we have solidarity, Western solidarity. The Americans don't give a hoot what happens to the Europeans at all, okay? And even less so about the Ukrainians, Larry.
Right. Yeah, no, they're almost being treated as if they're subhuman. The human toll that's being experienced both by the Ukrainians and by the Russians along the border with Ukraine is horrific. But Garland had it right with respect to when people are cold and hungry, all the other politics disappear. And there is such an enormous disconnect right now between the political leadership in Europe and in the United States, and between the people, the average citizen. Example, in Germany, they're talking about what, 3 in 10 businesses have already closed, and people are getting hit with utility bills that are 5, 6, sometimes 10 times what they were paying. Long family businesses that endured World War II, if you can imagine that, like a bakery, are being forced to close down. And what is the leadership in Germany talking about? Oh, we need to set up a fund to promote more green energy. I mean, good God, it's madness. Well, that's where they are.
And so, Larry, I was going to add on top of that is that, you know, now there's talk about giving food stamps to American military personnel because of inflation. And in the same news cycle, I don't know, anybody can tell me how many tranches of military aid has been sent to Ukraine this year? I've lost count. I've lost count of the number and the dollar price number here. I mean, it's amazing here. But I'm agreeing with Larry because this is an elite agenda here. Maxime, you know, we're talking about the minutiae now, but, you know, you're a geopolitical thinker. There's no way back. I mean, February 24th is a line in the sand because, as I said, like with Minsk 1 and 2, which is so obscure to Western audiences, you know, this is not the 7th or 8th month of this conflict. This is the 8th year of this conflict. People don't understand that in the West here. But, you know, Russia is making a complete reorientation elsewhere, because why would Russia, under any circumstances right now, deal with any of these Western leaders? They're obviously off their rocker. Go ahead.
Look, I have to say, and I think everyone understands that there is just not just one battle going on, but a few battles on a few levels at the same time. You know, Ukraine is a theater for really new world-making and meaning-making processes globally, obviously. And, you know, one way that European politicians seek to deal with it is not to seek solutions to the crisis and seek, you know, some kind of deal with Russia, so to say, but to channel the anger of their people that my colleagues spoke about to Russia, right? The comment by Ursula lately that you can send your, you know, bills to Moscow shows you that there are no solutions for the problems that people have, and instead they want to channel their anger towards Russia. That's one thing. Secondly, again, like I said, they believe that they by allocating more financial aid and military hardware to Ukraine is a solution, or if not the solution in their view, to the conflict. That I think is also is likely to fail. Secondly, I think both Moscow and Washington and Brussels and other capitals in the West realize that there is a really big global struggle for the opinions and the hearts and minds of the global South. And the fact that, you know, countries that are not in the West play a decisive role and how, you know, this conflict may play out in the welfare of Russia and the West is also telling that there is the era of 1990s, the kind of the unipolar moment is gone. And the multipolar world is in the making. And finally, I have to say there is a split between the interests of the United States and Europe, is the United States has been a lot more pragmatic than the Europeans in exporting Russian gas, you know, and in dealing with the crisis of oil and exporting other material and resources from Russia and trying to hedge their own risks here and then emerge as a quote unquote mediator in the conflict when everyone else finds themselves in terrible shape. That I think is also spotted in Moscow.
Yeah, well, it's really interesting, Garland, because the way I look at this here, the big picture of it all, the entire EU project and this ridiculous offensive organization, NATO, it's all on the line right now because everybody's all in on this here. That's why I said in my introduction, one side will lose and badly. And that's the stakes that we see right now. The entire EU project, I think, is at stake, and NATO is at stake here. And the Russians know it. Go ahead, Garland.
Yeah, because what we're seeing is a contradiction, an obvious contradiction between the U.S. empire and the concept of democracy. And so now we're seeing that the people in Europe are figuring out that they don't have democracy, they don't have independence, they don't have sovereignty, they don't have a leadership that is looking out for their constituency, and they're not going to be happy about that. I think you also have to look at this through the context worldwide and that the U.S. is trying to up the heat on Taiwan also. So to some extent, I think we have three superpowers. I believe we have a fairly responsible government in China, a fairly responsible government in Russia, and a bunch of med dogs in Washington. And that, unfortunately for Russia and China, it is kind of incumbent upon their leaders to usher in a new world order without provoking or without getting these med dogs to a point that they push a nuclear button. I believe it can be done, and I believe that's why Russia and China are showing so much constraint. I think they understand that, and I think they will be able to do that.
Okay, Larry, take a swing at that. That's really interesting what Garland just said there. Are there reasonable enough people in Washington to get, because we're in the Thucydides trap, okay? And we see it left, right, and center. Are they going to right to make the right decision? Evidence would say they won't. Go ahead, Larry.
Washington is infested with corrupt Lilliputians right now. All these tiny, tiny people with tiny, tiny brains running around. What has happened is, and Garland correctly noted it, when history looks back at this period, this will be the formation of a new world order in terms of the multipolarity, the end of United States hegemony in the world, the end of the United States as the holder of the reserve currency. And the United States did it to itself. Russia did not look for this conflict. They didn't try to provoke this. Russia kept looking and thinking, I think naively, that there was going to be some adult in Washington, D.C. that would step up and say, yeah, okay, look, let's put all this other nonsense aside. Let's talk. And they didn't do that. They said, yeah, we can defeat Russia. Let's impose sanctions. And not a single soul in the intelligence community, to the best I can determine, sat down and said, hey, what do we do about the fact that Russia is self-sufficient economically and controls a whole range of commodities and minerals and rare earth minerals that we need in the West to survive? Well, no, let's go ahead and try to set them on fire.
The interesting thing is that, you know, but Russia only makes up 3% of global GDP. Well, who would have thought that 3% was really important?
Yeah. Nobody sat down and counted the cost. I mean, that's what's so truly shocking about this. And now there is literally the economic tsunami that's headed our way. It's going to affect a global depression. If anybody thinks that the collapse of the economy in Germany, it will just be an isolated event, then, you know, there's no basis to have a discussion with somebody that's stupid.
Yeah, well, that's why, you know, I don't watch cable TV outside of Tucker Carlson. All right, gentlemen, fascinating discussion. I want to thank my guests in Washington, Tampa, and in Moscow. And I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.